This week's episode of War Rocket Ajax is brought to you by Loot Crate. Go over to lootcrate.com/WarRocketAjax and use the coupon code WarRocketAjax to get $3 off a new subscription.
Clytus, I'm bored. What plaything can you offer me today?
That's War Rocket Ajax, to bring back his body.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to War Rocket Ajax. This is the internet's most destructive comic book and pop culture podcast, and we are your hosts. My name is Chris Sims, and with me, as always, is Mr. Matt Wilson. Matt, how are you tonight?
I'm tired.
You know, I've been thinking, Matt, maybe we're going to get some new listeners one day. Maybe we should streamline the opening of the show. Maybe we should do the same thing every week so that we're all on the same page. But please, tell me right here and now at the start of the show, why are you so tired, buddy? You okay?
Well, I'm going to talk about it in my check. I was just up real late, but we'll talk about that later. But now we're going to talk about what a great show we have.
Have a great show this week.
We've got Chris Robertson, who you may know from iZombie, who you may know from Hellboy, who you may know from Edison Rex. He's going to be here talking to us about those three things, as well as his new novel, Firewalk. That guy's got a lot going on. And
why we're having him back on the show this week, in fact.
So we're going to talk about him about as much of that as we can, and it's going to be great. But before we get to that, Chris, we've got business to take care of, as always. And first of all, we're going to talk about our newest Patreon supporters.
That's right, Matt. These are the people who, the very kind-hearted souls, who swept up in the season of giving, have gone to patreon.com/WarRocketAjax and chipped in as little as a dollar every month. That's like 25 cents, occasionally 20 cents per episode, to help us keep the lights on and pay those gimmicks they keep sending in the mail called bills.
That's right. And our newest supporter on Patreon is Joshua Mostit.
Well, thank you, Joshua.
Or it might be Mustite. Sorry if I got that wrong, Joshua. But thank you for helping us out. If you would like to help us out, you can go to patreon.com/warrocketajax. Kick in, as Chris said, as little as a dollar to get ad-free episodes of the show at higher levels. People get bonus audio. Last week, folks got some real primo bonus audio with me, Chris, and Benito.
Can I just go ahead and say what it was?
Okay, reveal it.
Look, if you're on the fence, if you're like, hey, I don't know if the War Rocket Ajax Patreon is worth it, just consider that we did a commentary track for the music video The Witch's Invitation by contemporary Christian singer Carmen, something that we have talked about every year for the past 4 years.
Yep, we finally tackled it. Also, there are physical rewards. There are exclusive art pieces for Patreon supporters and all that cool stuff. So if any of that sounds cool to you, or if you would just like to help us out, you can go to Patreon and do that. All right, Chris, now that we have talked about Patreon a little bit, it's time for Checks and Wrecks.
Let's do it. So come on and check
yourself before you wreck yourself. Chris, what are you checking in with?
This week, I am checking in. First of all, the medical procedure that I had on Monday went fine, for anyone who was wondering. I don't want to be super gross.
You are here.
Yeah, so. I'm here. I am sitting upright. There was I don't want to get too gross, so I won't like super go into it, but I just had a thing removed from my side, and it was way bigger than I thought it was.
Well, it's good. Better out than in, as they say.
But I now have a like stitched up hole in my side, so I won't be able to do any working out for the next couple weeks. So, MMA update. Will return at some time in December.
MMA update, which we got a theme song for that we have not been able to use.
Which is amazing. Like, I wish there was an MMA update to give you so you could hear this.
You know what? I'm going to do this. I'm going to post the MMA update theme on Patreon for Patreon supporters to be able to listen to up until we can use the theme song for real on the show.
Okay, that is a great idea, because this is another theme song for War Rocket Ajax from our buddy Matt Fisher, and he asked me, what genre do you want an MMA update jingle in, because he did the same thing for Snack Situation. He's also the musician behind the Snack Situation jingle, and I think you handled that one, and you were just like hardcore.
Yeah, I said punk rock, but yeah, it would,
punk
yeah.
rock. So I told him 80s action movie training montage ballad, which turned out to be more difficult than he anticipated, but he did it. He persevered, and it's amazing.
Yeah, he really nailed it. He nailed it real good.
Yeah, so check that out, Patreon backers. Matt will put it up. But that has nothing to do with what I'm checking in with this week. It is National Novel Writing Month, which a lot of people observe, and I don't do that because I write all the time, constantly, anyway. And it's kind of a weird thing for, like, professional writers, even people who don't work in novels, to sort of, you know, keep track of their word count and everything. But I do know a couple of people who have decided this year to just use this as an excuse to stop putting off a project that they've been putting off for a while. That sounded good to me. So this week, since I wasn't able to do yoga or do MMA or work out at all, I decided that I am going to teach myself Twine, which is a program that's very simple to use that allows you to basically write a choose-your-own-adventure book. A lot of people have done this and put up some really fun stuff. There's a lot of really cool high-concept stuff. Like, there's one that takes place 10 seconds before the end of the world, and there's a countdown clock involved. But I'm not doing anything that high-concept. Right now, I'm basically just teaching myself the basics with kind of a standard sort of fantasy scenario. I've talked before about the Lone Wolf novels that Joe Deaver wrote that were, you know, the Choosable Path novels, and how much I really, really loved those as a kid. So I think those are kind of what I'm working up to. But for right now, I'm just going through, teaching myself this thing, learning and figuring out the variables and how I can use them. And I think this is going to be something that I'm going to put up, but I don't know how. I don't know what to do with it in a way that I can, that someone can give me like $2 to read this thing once I finished it, and it's a good sized, good length adventure. So if anybody has any suggestions on that, I know that Twine exports it as an HTML file. And I am, if you have Twine, you can open it up and see the story path. And honestly, I'm not worried about anyone getting in there and checking it out that way. So, like, maybe I could put it up on Gumroad or something. Or maybe people are just flat out not interested. So get in touch and tell me that, too. But, yeah, that is what I have been working on this week. And also, we put up the Christmas tree on November 1st, because that's how I roll.
Yeah, I saw them Instagrams of the Christmas tree going up on November 1st, and I said, that's that Chris Sims lifestyle.
It's a very pretty Christmas tree, Matt.
It looks real nice, and I saw the post that said, we need more lights, and then you got more lights.
Yep. There's pretty lights on the tree, Matt. I'm watching them shine.
That's wonderful. I'm very happy for you.
You should be here with me. Baby, please come home. Matt, what are you checking in with this week?
All right, we never talk about sports on this show, for good reason.
Not. Well, there's one sport we talk about very often.
The king of sports. But rarely do we talk about, I don't know how to distinguish pro wrestling from other sports. Non-predetermined sports, I guess.
Non-narrative sports.
Yeah. If you have kept track of my path in life, I lived in Chicago for quite a few years and lived very close to Wrigley Field in that time. If there's one sport that I've always been a fan of since I was a kid, it has been baseball. And the Cubs have always been a team I really liked. So staying up last night, the night before we're recording this, and watching the Cubs win the World Series was quite something. And Marlene and I, who really grew an attachment to the Chicago Cubs when we lived near Wrigley Field, and would... We're within walking distance of Wrigley, sometimes in the season, you know, because the seasons we were there, they were not good. And so we would walk to Wrigley and just, like, buy some cheap-ass bleacher tickets, nosebleed seat tickets or whatever. Whatever was available or we could pick up on StubHub or whatever. And we just go catch a late-season Cubs game, even though they were losing, they had no chance to go into the playoffs, whatever. It was just fun to go. It was just fun to go to Wrigley Field and go see the Cubs. And so, I've become a Cubs guy. I wear a Cubs hat around sometimes. We were up all night watching clips and commercials that came on after the game that were very emotionally manipulative.
Did you like the one with the little kid playing in that, like, really shitty ballpark?
The one with the little kid? All the Harry Carey ads were too fucking much. The one where they re-edited, like Harry Carey audio so that he was calling the last play of the game, that's nuclear. That's nuclear emotional manipulation shit. All the stuff with Bill, like somehow Bill Murray became the star of the period after the game, like the post game, where he's like interviewing people in the locker room and stuff. But it was really awesome. It was just Marlene and myself and a friend of ours who lived in Chicago for a long time, who lives here now, just like watching the game here. And we were freaking out during that rain delay. And when the Cleveland team tied it up 6-6, I think our neighbors probably heard all of us yell fuck at the same time. and then they won the game and we screamed and it was great. We had a bunch of candy left over from Halloween and watched the World Series. Yeah,
I actually watched it as well, which is unusual for me. I am not a man of the lesser sports. I think is how I usually describe it. Aiden was watching it. This is how nerdy I am. Like, I had to stop my weekly RPG game a little bit early so I could go watch it with Aiden, because I was like, oh, well, it's the ninth inning, so this is about to end, and then it did not end.
I watched every game of the World Series, and I watched the Cubs go all the way through the playoffs, and it was – It's really something to follow a team all the way through, especially when that team has not won in 108 years. So,
yeah, I didn't realize it had been 108 years since they won the World Series.
Yeah.
That's a very long time.
That's enough about that. Chris, yeah. Let's make some recommendations.
Okay, so this week's rec isn't actually a rec. It's something I think both of us really want to talk about, though. Legends of Tomorrow is the worst show on television, and I love it.
You know, they made some adjustments this season. Weirdly enough, in our recaps, I feel like Dylan and I are not cracking on the show as much as we did the first season, where the show was very up and down, and we absolutely hated Rip Hunter. But this season, the first couple episodes, maybe three episodes, were pretty consistently all right. The episode that aired just before we started recording was a big drop off in quality.
It is very curious that you consider, like, because look, I'm watching stuff on the CW app.
Yeah.
So I'm a little bit behind because I'm trying to keep up with Legends of Tomorrow and Flash and Crazy Ex-Girlfriend and Jane the Virgin and Supergirl, all shows that I really, really like. But because the only device we have in the house that can play it is the iPad, like, it's just we go to bed and then watch a CW show for an hour. So I'm a couple behind in Legends of Tomorrow. Matt, you write the recaps of the show. Who are you teaming up with this season?
It's Dylan Todd and myself again doing it for a second season.
Here's my question. Why does everybody constantly shit on Ray Palmer, who should be the fucking man on that show?
Well, get to episode 3.
Okay.
Get to episode 3.
Is that the samurai episode that I tapped out of watching, like, with 10 minutes left in it?
It is the samurai episode, yes.
Watching the Justice Society episode, I almost lost my fucking mind, because there's a part where Vixen comes in and she's like looking at Ray Palmer, and Ray Palmer is standing there, the most beautiful man in the world, because he's Brandon Routh, if you haven't watched it, with his shrinking Iron Man suit that he made. Mm-hmm. And Vixen goes, oh, so your power is that you wear a suit? And I lost it. I'm in bed with Aiden, and I turn and I go, like, oh, Mary, what's your power? Is it just wearing a totem? Did you just wear that thing, and that's how you get your powers? That you didn't even make? You didn't even make that. It was given to you. Is that how you get your powers? Because everyone's constantly shitting on Ray, and I don't understand why.
I believe this version of Vixen is not Mary. It's her.
Not,
It's her grandmother.
Okay, so first of all, that's going to be Ray's season arc, apparently, about finding the hero within himself that is not from the suit. And look, I'm not trying to defend Vixen for shitting on this awesome suit that Ray Palmer built himself.
Yeah, no, like, but it's not just her is the thing. It's everybody on that show is always like Heatwave, I'll give it to you. You know, Heatwave the human puppy dog, I will give you, like, bickering with Ray. Oh, haircut. But, like, everybody seems to forget that. And the reason they forget is because that show's budget does not allow for Brandon Routh to fly around in his Iron Man shooting out lasers and shrinking down to microscopic size, which is, he is easily the most powerful person on the show, except for maybe Firestorm, except for the show keeps manufacturing reasons why those dudes won't turn into fucking Firestorm.
They're not even manufacturing it anymore. Now it's just the team's like, yeah, we don't need you.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, so this season
don't come.
Opened.
Don't come, just stay on the ship. We don't need a Firestorm.
Yeah, we don't need a flying nuclear man to help us out with this situation. Here's what I love about that show is Sarah Lance, time lesbian.
Yeah, she's the best character on the show.
She's the best character on the show. I love that she just basically is traveling through time seducing women.
Now, she is...
That part's amazing.
She is canonically bisexual.
Okay.
But she does do a lot of seducing women.
I've never watched Arrow, and she only has ever, like... She really does a lot of hooking up with ladies in Blades of Tomorrow, so apologies if she's bisexual.
There's a little bit of, like, weird tension in the most recent episode between her and Ray Palmer 2, Nate Haywood. But I don't know if that's going to pay off in any way.
Oh yeah, fuck that guy, by the way.
Well, he's a second attempt at Rip Hunter, right? Like he's there to contextualize everything for everybody and be like, "Oh, this is the effect on history of this," cuz he's a historian.
Yeah. That's the thing that like I'm over here flipping out about DC Universe shit. Aiden's in bed going like when he's like, "Yeah, I'm a historian. Nobody knows history more than I do." And Aiden's like, "What kind of historian are you? You know all of history? You know everything about all of history because you didn't leave the house for 10 years."
The answer is yes, he knows all of history. But he's a second attempt at doing Rip Hunter cuz I don't know if this is the reason, but like all the audience including Dylan and myself fucking hated Rip Hunter cuz he was a dick to the entire team for the whole season.
I loved Rip Hunter.
I fucking hate Rip Hunter. But Rip was at least different from everybody else. Now you just have two nice guys with good hair. Who are kind of
better
awkward.
Call Ray with the good hair. Here's the thing. The opening to this season has like it's got my favorite moment of the show, which is when they have to rescue Sarah Lance from witch trial times, and you find out that they are going to burn her at the stake because she has been seducing too many wives.
Uh-huh.
And she like, you know, gives like a head nod to Goody Thomas or whatever at the side. That's the best part. The medium part of the opening is when they go get Ray Palmer back from Dinosaur Times, and you think for a second that they're going to do Sword of the Atom, and they're going to show up, and Rip Hunter's going to be like, Ray Palmer's going to be like, "Yeah, I've been here for like 6 months. I'm a super badass barbarian king now." But they don't do that either, which is fine because I don't expect them to do Sword of the Atom on television. The worst part is when they go to King Arthur Times and they get Jax and Stein, and they're like, "Yeah. Bring me my court wizards." And I'm like, "Oh, right. Of course these guys are the court wizards." And then Jax like pulls out his iPhone and he's like, "Do you want to see some more iPhone magic?" And I'm like, "You two dudes can become Firestorm, a man on fire who flies and turns things into other things. What are you doing?"
I thought the iPhone thing was not a terrible gag.
Not a terrible gag for anybody who's not fucking Firestorm.
Well, you know, in King Arthur times, they might have thought that was an actual demon and killed them. Who knows?
Matt, you're writing justifications for this bullshit. Anyway, Legends of Tomorrow is 100% pure trash garbage, and I will watch every episode.
This is the only way I can stay sane. This is what happened to me with Arrow last season, where I have to, like, legitimize and rationalize everything. Otherwise, I'll lose my fucking mind trying to watch this stuff and just and write about it. All right, I've calmed down now.
Yeah, but you're not on the Arrowbeat anymore. You're done with Stephen Amell.
According to Chris Haley, Arrow got good, and one, I don't believe him, and two, if it took me leaving the show for it to get good, great.
Just real quick aside, I hate Barry Allen. He is once again the biggest villain of the universe, and Barry Allen's concept of time travel and Legends of Tomorrow's concept of time travel, despite existing in the same universe and sharing characters, are not the same concepts of time travel. Let's see. Also, Supergirl rules. Supergirl's great, and I love Supergirl unreservedly. So that's it. That's DC TV Corner.
My rec is music that you can go buy, an album. It's by a... I don't know if it's a group or just one person or what, but it's called Carpenter Brute, and the album is called Trilogy. We've talked on here before about how much we enjoy Perturbator, who does kind of dark synth. I guess that's what you would call it. Synth wave,
yeah.
Carpenter Brute falls into that category as well, but sort of falls in between what Perturbator does and if you are familiar with Justice.
I love Justice.
Who actually just put out a new album that I need to listen to. I really loved Justice's first album, Genesis, and it's got a similar sound to that album, and it's got a little bit of Perturbator in it, and it kind of meets in the middle, and it's really good. Marlene described it as electronic metal, which is pretty on point. But I really like this album. I've been listening to it a lot. We had a Halloween party here on Halloween, and I just turned that on and just had it playing the whole time because it is perfect music for a Halloween party. Like, I'll listen to it anytime, but it is really great music for a Halloween party. And another thing that I would suggest you do, if you're on the fence about buying the album, just based on my description, go on YouTube and look up Carpenter Brute's song Turbo Killer and watch the video for Turbo Killer, because it's fucking rad. I'm not exactly sure what the story it's trying to tell is. Like, it's a short film. It seems to be a story about an alien mom and dad saving their daughter from Earth criminals. That's just my initial read of it. And the alien dad is a gas mask wearing guy with glowing eyes who drives a fast sports car. But the look of that video is so my aesthetic. It's got this great neon tinge to the whole thing. It's got these insane car chases. Everybody has these like glowing... Or the alien characters have these like glowing crosses on their foreheads. The gas mask guy has these yellow glowing eyes, and the car chase that ends it is so cool. I just really dig that video, and I dig that song, and then the rest of the album. I went and got the rest of the album, and it's good stuff. So if you're not like Chris and you're not fully in Christmas music mode yet, and you want something to listen to, Carpenter Brute Trilogy, good stuff. Chris, let's talk about some comics. There were a couple of really smartly timed comics that came out this week to coincide with coming out just before Election Day in the United States. Election Day, the day that this podcast comes out, is tomorrow. And... these comics came out last Wednesday. There was a Bitch Planet that was kind of election focused. I think there was one or two other election books, and then there was Catwoman Election Night, a one shot special that came out this week that has two stories in it: a Catwoman story and a Prez story that I think is the last story in the DCU incarnation of Prez, which I described as going hard, and boy does it go hard.
I feel like it's not out of the question that we might see more Prez at some point. I feel like there have been comments to that effect, but I don't know for sure if that's just wishful thinking, because that's a book I really, really liked while it was coming out. But yeah, this one goes for it. This is, if you want to know what Prez was about, this is the one. This is the one to read.
All right, so let me run down the creative teams. Meredith Finch and Shane Davis do the Catwoman story, which I guess we should briefly talk about. I don't hate that Catwoman story. It does explicitly make the Penguin Donald Trump in a Penguin like for Mayor story, like to the point where he wants to build a wall around Gotham City.
He wants to build a wall around Gotham City to keep crime out of Gotham City, which I think is pretty hilarious. I would maybe ding it for a lack of subtlety if anything in the world right now had anything remotely resembling subtlety going on. We talked about that World Series game. That was very written. That was narrative.
Yeah, it was narrative for sure.
The Catwoman story I thought was fine.
It took a weird turn where suddenly Catwoman was bringing down the Penguin's opponent because of stuff that happened in the orphanage where she grew up, which was not something I expected to happen. But it's not a bad story. Then the Prez story by Mark Russell and Ben Caldwell. Like, if you thought the Prez series that came out last year, the year before, those issues, like, that was, you know, political satire, this is even more baldly political satire that somehow brilliantly combines like guns, mass shootings, gun control, and birth control controversy, women's health controversy into one story.
Yeah. What was really interesting to me this week was to read this Prez story and also get a new issue of the Flintstones comic, also written by Mark Russell, that was an election special. And to sort of compare those two, because we've talked before about how I never had any question that Prez was working, whereas Flintstones I've had a much tougher path of kind of getting behind. And I think a lot of that has to do with context, because, again, like, Prez is rooted in, if not political satire, in DC Comics doing weird political stuff that's, you know, for the youth, in Joe Simon and Jerry Grant, the 90s original. Whereas, how did we get to this point where we're living in a world where there was a new issue of the Flintstones where Fred Flintstone says the words, "We participated in a genocide," in dialogue, and then that's what the story is about?
Yeah, I mean, we talked about this when we talked about Flintstones last time, how somehow Prez and the Flintstones, I mean, I guess by virtue of the fact that they have the same writer, have the same satirical edge. Mm-hmm. To the point where, like, if you're reading this Prez story, like, there's some stuff in the first few pages that might make you go, oh, right? Like, it really edges up to that line.
Yeah.
Of being, like, too much, almost. But then the story, you know, winds its way around and comes to this, like, satisfying, clever, funny ending. Like, the sort of gruesome, almost, satire of the first couple pages of that Prez issue, or of that Prez story, man, it's brutal.
Like, it works really well, though, I think. Like, I really, really enjoyed this and was glad to see Prez back. And back in a form where I feel like this could have been Prez number 7, you know?
Yeah.
But I thought it was really enjoyable and really, really sharp satire, which is still kind of surprising, even having had Prez around for so long. But yeah, like, it goes in a place you don't expect, and it, like, and the thing about it is, Beth can't win this one, because this is an issue that we're still dealing with today. Like, these are both issues that we're still dealing with.
But then she figures out a way to win it.
She figures out a way to win. There's a really good line in it where somebody tells her, yeah, well, you can't win them all. And Beth goes, yeah, but you can win about half of them. That's a really inspiring quote, I think.
Yeah, but like that last panel where she sends the one other woman who showed up at the Women's Health Conference.
Yeah.
Which is a great, incisive point. She figures it out. She figures out the middle way. Because she couldn't win the gun thing, right? But she could figure out a way to win the birth control thing by using how she couldn't win the gun thing.
Yeah.
And it's all that storytelling is there in one panel. There's so much storytelling economy in that story.
It's really subtle too. And that in terms of format, and this is not me, you know, knocking the story because I think it's really well done, but it does make me wonder if this was Prez number 7 and it had to be chopped for a lower page count.
Yeah, it might have been Prez 7 and 8. You know, it could be condensed even more. One thing I will say is that this story made me really intensely want to see Beth Ross adjusted to her role as president and just stories about that.
Yeah.
You know, because yeah. A lot of what we got of Beth Ross in the Prez series was her getting elected and then having to adjust. This issue, yeah. She is president now and working her way into figuring out how to actually accomplish things. And I love it.
Yeah, I don't think she was elected until like number 2 or 3.
Right.
In Prez. So we never got to see her really as president. And getting that here was good. It's weird to imagine people who are picking this up as the Catwoman election night special and then getting this weird, weird Prez story involved.
Let's burn through these next two comics. North Star is number 1 is a book you wanted to talk about, Chris. I believe this is coming out from Action Lab, correct?
Yes, this is the first issue of North Stars, and it's actually written by Jim and Hagen Shelley, with art by Annalisa Jones. Long, long, long time listeners may recall that Jim Shelley is the first person to ever pay me and Chad to write comics, circa 2007. I actually, you can go read a Christmas comic that I wrote for Jim all those years ago, that I still think is okay. It's not, there's some stuff I would have done differently, but I still think it's kind of fun. This is Jim writing with his daughter, a book about Santa and his daughter, and sort of Santa's daughter's adventures. It's sort of a kid-friendlier take on a similar idea to what you would see in, like, Jingle Bell, but Holly is a very, very different character than Jingle, obviously. I think the gag with Jingle Bell is that she's the rebellious teenage daughter, but Holly is, you know, a little younger, a little friendlier with her dad, and off on some adventures. The art in this is beautiful, and it's mainly a team-up story between Holly, the daughter of Santa Claus, and Frostina, a Yeti princess, going on an adventure underground to stop a problem with Christmas coal. And I know that I am in the Christmas season mood way sooner than everybody else is. But if you're looking for like a fun all-ages Christmas read, this is a really, really good one. And one of the really cool things about it is that there's a character who only talks, who doesn't speak the language that the other characters speak. He's like a little kid goblin, and he only speaks in these pictures. And the pictures that he speaks in are drawn by Hagen, who is Jim's 11-year-old daughter, who is co-writing the book. It's really, really fun. Definitely check it out. It's out from Action Lab, and it's on Comixology. Jim's a great guy, and he's been a great friend for years. And has a really sharp mind for comics. So definitely check it out. It's really, really good.
The last book that I want to talk about a little bit is Occupy Avengers number 1, which is by David Walker and Carlos Pacheco. Boy, I just want to say, Carlos Pacheco is always really good. I didn't know what to expect necessarily from the story of the comic, other than, you know, generally I like David Walker. I know that this series has been getting some flack over its title because Occupy Avengers seems like it should have been the title of a comic 5 or 6 years ago or more. that's kind of a weird part of it. But the idea of it is that Hawkeye, having Hawkeye Clint Barton, having, you know, done some stuff that he's not proud of, namely killing Bruce Banner, spoiler alert, if you haven't read the series that happened in. But he's kind of like deciding that he wants to go do some good in the world and help people who need help. So he goes to this reservation that has contaminated water, and basically with the idea of, I'm going to fix this. I'm going to fix the water problem here. And that's where he ends up running into Red Wolf, who is basically like, okay, you're not going on this reservation by yourself. I'm coming with you, and you're going to actually go talk to these people and see them. And what ends up happening is a Hawkeye-Red Wolf team-up fighting against like paramilitary guys who look kind of like the S.H.I.E.L.D., weirdly enough.
Wait, they look kind of like the Strategic Hazard Intervention Espionage Logistics Directorate, or they look like Seth Rollins, Roman Reigns, and Dean Ambrose?
Yeah, they look like Sierra Echo Lima Delta.
Okay.
Whatever. Sierra Hotel. I've missed some of that. Anyway.
It's fine. I gotcha.
They look like the wrestling version of the S.H.I.E.L.D. because of the masks that they have. But there's a team up where they you know, fight jerks who are profiteering on contaminating this water. And there are also like conversations about Hawkeye's privilege. But Hawkeye doesn't come out of it looking bad. He comes out of it looking like a guy who wants to do some good, but is maybe kind of naive about it in certain ways. Which, one, Hawkeye's a great character to do that with. Cause this is a great marriage, I feel like, of the Hawkeye that we've come to know in recent years from the Matt Fraction, David Aja series, and like classic Hawkeye, superhero Hawkeye. So, you know, he never comes off looking bad for wanting to go do this thing, but he also learns some stuff about his privilege. Red Wolf clues him into some things. He meets some of the people who have been living on this reservation for years and years and kind of finds out about what their actual struggles are. Like, it gets some real stuff into this book without being preachy about it and getting an actual superhero adventure story in there, which seems like an impossible task in a first issue of a comic book. And Walker and Pacheco pull it off. So in general, I really liked it. I want to see where it goes from here. And it seems weird to have an Avengers team that's just two people. It seems like there need to be more people on the team. But as far as like establishing a tone of like superheroes dealing with quote unquote real world problems, I feel like Occupy Avengers does it without being preachy and without being like, you know, there's always a slippery slope when you're talking about superheroes dealing with real world stuff, right? But they walk that tightrope and do a good job of it. All right, Chris, that's our comic segment. Before we head on to our interview with Chris Robertson, let's talk a little bit about Loot Crate.
Talk about lootcrate.com/WarRocketAjax?
And the coupon code WarRocketAjax. It's November. Spooky time is over. And we're heading toward the holidays. And if there's one unifying theme between the spooky time of October and the time that brings us together, the most wonderful time of the year in the December holidays, it's a certain kind of magic. Whether it's spooky magic or special magic, there's magic in this time of year, which is why the November Loot Crate theme is magical.
Do you think the opposite of spooky magic is special magic? Because that is what you said.
What is wonderful magic? Is that better?
I would have just said Christmas magic or holiday magic.
Jolly magic?
The magic of giving, maybe?
I'm trying to be inclusive, okay?
Okay, look, that's fair. It's you went about it in an unusual way, is all I'm saying.
Inclusive ended up being vague, and I apologize, okay? Whatever you want to call holiday magic, maybe we will just call it holiday magic. It's a unifying thing. If you want to tap into that magic, you can get the November Loot Crate right now. You want to hear about some stuff that's in that November Loot Crate, Chris?
I would love to hear about that, Matt, because magic is a broad category, right? Magic involves a lot of things. There's a lot of different kinds of magic. There's spooky magic. There's holiday magic. There's special magic.
That's right. I think special magic is like a certain category that you could use in like a Final Fantasy game or something. But anyway,
right? It's next to fight magic and run magic.
It's like a double tech in Chrono Trigger. Mm-hmm. But here's some of the franchises that you can get 100% exclusive items from in November. Okay. All right, Doctor Strange.
Okay, he's magical.
Timely, Fantastic Beasts and Where to Find Them.
Also very, very timely.
Big Trouble in Little China.
Okay, no, I would have never put Big Trouble in Little China in the magical category. If I'm John Loot Crate, John Worthington Loot Crate IV, CEO
founder of Loot Crate.
And founder of Loot Crate.
Yeah.
Loot Crate Industries Worldwide Limited LLC. If I have some exclusive Big Trouble in Little China merchandise, I'm not going to put it in the magical box. That's not the kind of thing that would occur to me. But you know what? I'm a dude who likes Doctor Strange, I'm a dude who likes Harry Potter, and I'm a dude who loves Big Trouble in Little China, and there's plenty of magic in that movie. There's a six demon bag, there's the black blood of the earth, there's that weird beholder monster, all kinds of magic in that movie.
That it, you could call both spooky and special.
Nope. Yes, you could.
If you want that stuff, and more, because there's more in that box too, here's what you do. Before November 19th, go to lootcrate.com/WarRocketAjax. Enter the coupon code WarRocketAjax. Subscribe to Loot Crate. And you will get $3 off your brand new subscription. And you will get all that magical stuff with every possible kind of magic in that box.
All three.
That's right, all three kinds. Let's talk to Chris Robertson.
For the program this week, we are pleased to welcome back to the show one of our earliest guests, I think, way back in what I would consider to be season one of War Rocket Ajax, the Rusty Shackles era, coming back to talk about his new role as, I guess, the co-writer of all the new Hellboy stuff. Is that right?
Most of it. There's still a few things that don't have my name on them, but certainly the lion's share I'm doing.
Okay, so the co-writer of the lion's share of Hellboy, the writer of Edison Rex, the co-creator of iZombie, and the author of the new novel Firewalk, Chris Robertson, welcome back to the show. How are you? It's been forever since we've talked.
It has been forever. I'm very good, thank you.
I guess where I want to start talking to you, because I emailed you, like, maybe 6 months ago.
Yeah.
Because I finally got around to watching iZombie. I really, really like the show. And I like the show for completely different reasons than I like the comic.
Right.
Because it's such a different thing. And I was wondering what that's like for you to be the co-creator of a comic that gets adapted and the adaptation is so different. But it's not, like, different in a terrible way.
Right. There's two kind of analogies that I normally use. And one is that in comic terms, it's like I'm Marty Nodell. I created – crap, I just forgot the name of the Golden Age Green Lantern. I'm going to be laughing at him. Alan Scott. Somebody else has come along and done the Hal Jordan version. Or I usually use Jay Garrick and Barry Allen. Because it's the same name. It's the same basic concept. It's just a different explanation, and it's a different outfit. You know, basically new characters with a new story, but the same basic seed. But it's weird. There's a weird kind of like distancing effect for me because, you know, it's every time the credits start, you know, and you get that great animated Mike Allred opening, I'm like, that's our comic. That looks like our comic, just with different characters in the roles. And tonally, it feels really similar to our comic, you know, like they're very close cousins. It's just a different kind of story. What I have found is that people that like the comic and then read then see the show for the first time tend to like it. And people that are fans of the TV show first and then go to the comic also tend to like it because there's not this expectation that oh, you know, I know how this is going to go, and if it doesn't go that way, I feel betrayed. You know, so I feel if it was a closer adaptation, the differences would be more jarring, but because they're so different, nobody cares. Everyone just likes it.
What have your interactions been like at conventions with people who are fans of the show and haven't read the comic yet? And you know, they come to the table, I assume you have, you know, copies of the books. Mm-hmm. And they look through it and they see that it's rather different. Like, what do you tell them? What do you tell somebody who's a fan of the show who you think might, you know, you want them to check out the book and they're interested, but they see that it's a different thing?
I usually point out that the guy who made the opening titles that they like so much drew this whole thing. And that, as I say, they're very tonally very similar. So you can go in, the voiceover narration feels like the internal monologue of our character, for example. So, like, and a lot of times it echoes things. And there's weird places where there's really close congruence because they use the comics in hair and makeup and wardrobe a lot. And so very often, Rose MacIver will turn up in an outfit that, you know, 7 years ago, Mike Allred drew for our character. So,
Chris, you mentioned Rose MacIver.
I did.
Who's great on the show. I was wondering if you were aware that she was not only a Power Ranger, but a Power Ranger on my favorite season of Power Rangers ever.
Well, I knew the first half of that. I'm afraid that I don't keep close enough tabs on what are your favorite seasons of these things. But
that's ridiculous, because if you literally give me 5 minutes, I will tell you.
Yeah, but then I don't retain that information. That's the problem. Yeah, I did not know that. But yeah, I did know she was the yellow Power Ranger, right?
See,
I know.
Yeah, she was. She was the yellow RPM Ranger.
See, I know what's going on.
Just like next time you see her, just tell her I'm a fan. That's
okay.
All.
This guy I know is a fan. Yep.
I'll tell her.
A very dear friend of mine who is obsessed with these things.
Yes, there we go. No, but getting back to the idea of adaptations, you being a guy that I've talked to about being a fan of so much stuff, like, you've been on the show before, like, not necessarily in your capacity as a writer or as a publisher or a novelist or all of these things that you've done. We've literally just had you on the show before to talk about how much you love Superman.
Yeah, yeah.
When I think about comic books that are turned into TV shows or movies, the thing that always turns me off are those moments where they hew too close to being a strict adaptation.
Yeah.
Like, is that something that you find as well, where you just want to see, like, the sort of essence of a story put in a new medium?
Oh, totally. I mean, you know, I think that that's exactly it, because it's an adaptation. You're adapting it to better survive in a different medium. And you can't just use, you know, a comic page or even a comic panel as a storyboard for how it's going to work, because it might not work at all. In some cases, you could have kind of close similarities, but I mean, one of my favorite adaptations of something that I am very passionate fan of was the Legion of Superheroes cartoon that James Tucker did a few years ago, which was very different than every version of the Legion that we'd ever seen, but felt exactly like what I loved most about those characters.
I actually never watched that show.
Ooh, it's really good.
I read some of the comics because the tie-in comics, like, had these easy plots for me to get behind. Like, there was one that had a character named Teen Lantern.
Okay, yep.
Which I thought was brilliant.
Yep.
And her name was Jordana Gardner.
Yeah, that's good.
And she was the Teen Green Lantern. And I was like, wait, so is she the descendant of Hal Jordan and Guy Gardner? And them specifically? Is that how she works?
That
I was very intrigued.
Sure, why not?
But I never actually...
It's the future.
No, I mean, look, I'm fine with it. Like, I think that would make both those characters way better if they were.
Doesn't make sense, because in my head, it's as though Hal Jordan and Guy Gardner are a couple. Then that's how they're
right.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. That's what I'm.
All right. Cool. And then we're on the same wavelength. Then I'm telling you, don't be so judgy. So.
Yes. Okay. I'm glad we explained this conversation for the benefit of the listeners. No, but that's a cartoon that I. That and The Batman are the ones I've never seen. I should, by all rights, have watched both of those.
Well, the Batman, that was the CGI one, right? Or were you talking about the one before that?
Actually, Beware the Batman, I only saw a couple episodes of, and then it got pulled from regular rotation, and they were airing it at 2 o'clock in the morning.
Yeah, they were.
So those are the only couple episodes I saw, and I really want to see the whole thing because it's like, how is there a Batman show that only goes like 12 episodes?
I thought it was great. I mean, I thought having Katana as a sidekick was awesome. It's a great creative choice. I feel like we're kind of getting in the weeds, but to go circle back to your original point, I think it's very good when adaptations are very different, but they do contain the essence of a thing. So
you don't feel possessive of because iZombie as a comic is a, you know, starts out with a very the very simple same high concept of the show. Girl is a zombie. Girl eats brains. Girl gets memories. Girl solves crimes. But over the course of iZombie as a comic, it gets, you know, vastly different and more complicated, and has a mythology that's all unto its own. Like, when you look at it, are you just like, oh, right, well, I did that, so that is done. Like, that does not need to be done elsewhere.
Well, I think that realistically, when I was coming up with iZombie as a comic originally, even before Allred was involved, I was thinking about it in terms of, like, how could you adapt this to other media? And so I was thinking in pretty practical terms. So, for example, in the first 5 issues, the characters only go to 3 places. Like, everything that happens takes place in 1 of 3 places. Because in my head, 2 of those were sets, and 1 of those would be a location, right? And so I'm thinking practically in those terms, and it didn't even occur to me that, like, you know, the were-terrier and the ghost effect would be hard to pull off. You know, like, that didn't even bubble up in my brain. And but the other thing was that, you know, as it went along, I just kind of, it was a kind of kitchen sink thing, because I thought, well, I don't know how long I'm going to be able to do this. I don't know how long this series is going to run. I don't know how long I'm going to get paid to make comics. I'm going to cram everything I like in this one place. So things that, you know, I could have easily just been their own comic, I've just kind of made them fit in that. Like the Dead Presidents, which you know, like halfway through, these undead secret agents show up. And they even had their own logo. But it was just, you know, I want to see Mike Allred draw that thing, so I'll put it in this book. So I don't feel like, you know, it doesn't hurt my feelings in the slightest that the TV show went a different direction. But the other thing I should specify is that, like, I intentionally remain in the dark about where the show is going. You know, so I early on, I would see scripts, or I'd see rough cuts, and I would, in conversation with Rob and Diane, Rob Thomas and Diane Ruggiero, right, I'd talk to them about what was going to happen. But now I don't want to know. I just want to watch the show. Like, I have no interest in finding out what's going to happen next. So maybe stuff will show up. I don't know.
You mentioned Mike Allred.
I did.
Who's fantastic. As I think we all know, I think you were on the show the first time you were on, back when iZombie was just getting started, and you talked about how Mike Allred, how you got a creator-owned book at Vertigo with Mike Allred.
Yeah.
Which was just you saying, like, I don't know who should draw it. Maybe somebody like Mike Allred. And that's how it happened.
Yeah.
So how did you get hooked up with Mike Mignola to be as involved in Hellboy as you currently are?
Well, that kind of boils down to me being a giant fan again, because I had known Mike socially, this being Mike Mignola, I'd known him socially for, I don't know, like 8 years or something. 8 years now, so at the time, a couple years ago, it would have been like 6 years, because that's how math works. And discovered very early on that he had bought a bunch of the small press prose books that I published with Allison Baker as Monkey Ring Books. So that was nice. So it was nice to know that he was a fan of the nonfiction and story collections I'd done. But Mike didn't read my stuff, because I think he has a self-preservation instinct that maybe this guy who he's friendly with might suck at what he does, and he would rather just be friendly with me than know that I'm a horrible writer. So a couple years ago, I was doing an Aliens miniseries for Scott Alley at Dark Horse, and I got that job because the person that was originally going to do it had to back out for scheduling conflicts at the last minute. And they just fell in my lap because, like, I was local and cheap. You know, our kids went to the same elementary school, so I saw them all the time. And he knew he could get me on short notice, which was true. And when that wrapped up, I still needed more work. I made Scott go out to lunch with me, and I just begged him for a job. I said, like, do you have anything that I could do? Is there anything that you need scripts written for? And he started rattling off a bunch of properties that, you know, it was video game stuff and different franchises. And I was like, yeah, okay, I can make that work. I can figure out something to do for this thing I have no affinity for. And then he got to Witchfinder. And I was like, wait, is that a possibility? Is it a possibility to write a Witchfinder story? Which is, Witchfinder, the Victorian occult detective, is my favorite corner of the Hellboy universe. And so I was given the go-ahead to go write a pitch for them to take a look at. And Hellboy and the BPRD is one of two big franchises, or big, you know, personal creator-owned universes, that I reread in its entirety about once a year, once every 2 years, and it takes longer as it goes on because they keep making more of them. The other one, parenthetically, is Astro City, which I'm in the process of rereading right now. So I went away and I came back with like a crazy detailed outline for what became City of the Dead that pulled from every different corner of the Hellboy and BPRD oeuvre. Scott and Mike really liked it. And so I did that job, and it was right around that time that John Arcudi decided to step away from BPRD to focus on creator-owned stuff. And so they were left trying to figure out who was going to pick that up. They finally said, oh, Chris might want it. And they asked me, like, Mike wasn't sure I would want to do it. And I'm like, are you kidding me? I get to write Hellboy, like, forever? That's amazing. So that's not what I do. That's my job now is to be the steward of the Hellboy, BPRD, etc. backstory, you know, filling in all the historical period pieces.
I cannot imagine thinking, eh, he probably won't want to write Hellboy.
That's me, man. So, like, that guy, I mean, he's one of my favorite people. He's also very humble in some ways. So, for example, I know that you might be excited about this one a little bit. The Visitor, which was announced a couple weeks ago, which is the book I'm doing with Paul Grist. Did you know about this one? So, yeah, Paul Grist.
I knew about that one.
Paul Grist.
I knew about that one.
Well, so I've been wanting to drag Grist in on something since I got this job, you know, because the question mark crime outfit in Jack's staff is like really close cousin to like what I like doing with BPRD back in the 50s and 60s and stuff. And so when we started talking about doing The Visitor, I was like, well, why don't we see if Paul Grist will do it? And Mike was like, he probably wouldn't want to do it. And I was like, you could ask him. And then Mike said, well, you know, and I'm just like a guy that follows him on the Facebook and Twitter. Like, Paul Grist doesn't know me from Adam, but at this point, but you know, earlier. So Mike said, well, I don't know, do you think you should ask him, or do you want me to? And I'm like, I think that Mike Mignola should ask him if he wants to draw it, not just some random dude on Facebook. So that's how that job happened.
Yeah, like, Grist is so amazing. Like, if people have listened to this show before or read anything I've written for Comics Alliance, they'll know how I feel about Paul Grist. Like, you've talked before about reading stuff. Like, you talked specifically about Benito and stuff that he's done in Hectoplasm, where, like, there are things in there that you can't figure out how he did them as a writer.
Yeah.
And, like, everything in, like, every page of Jack Staff is, how did this happen for me?
Yeah.
Every page of you know, even like Demon Nick, which just ran in Judge Dredd magazine, I'm like, yep, this is incredible. Is that exactly
crazy intimidating for the guy who is, I think, probably my favorite cartoonist, my favorite living cartoonist. He's definitely like in the top four, you know, but like in the running would be also Mike Mignola and Jaime Hernandez and Paul Grist, and probably one spot open for somebody else. But like, it was incredibly stressful and intimidating, because like when I sat down to do it, I was like, oh, like I can't, I don't have to just like come up with like, here's what happens and give him a vague idea of like what I think it should look like. I've got to try to rise to the level of his skill, like just to give him stuff to work with. But at the same time, being very, very clear with him that like, you are way better at this than me, so if you see a better way to handle any of this, ignore what I say and just go for it.
How do you write a script like that? Because I know that my experience of script writing is that when I started out, I was very definitive of the picture I had in my head of what I wanted things to look like, and then cut to, you know, 7, 8, 9 years later, most of the time it's just, you know, Rogue's in this panel.
Yeah,
hey, it's Rogue and Gambit.
Yeah.
Rogue's talking to Gambit on the balcony. And that's, you know, a lot of that comes from being comfortable with the person you're collaborating with. A lot of that comes from, you know, kind of learning that you don't always have to put all the details in. But when you are working with a Mike Mignola or a Mike Allred even, or a Paul Grist, like, how do you do it? Like, how do you tell them what to do?
Well, the thing is, it's less that I'm telling them what to do than I'm describing what I think they're going to do. So, like, if I'm working with an artist whose work I'm familiar with, in particular, all three of those names you just mentioned, people who I've digested a lot of their work, I'm imagining what the story I have in my head would look like if they executed it. And then I kind of, like, I'm describing that to them. So it's this weird kind of echo chamber thing in my head, because I'm like, you know, what I think Grist would do with this is this. And in a lot of cases, I'm wrong. There's some structural bits in the first issue of Visitor where I really wanted to, like, do some of the cool little fiddly visual bits and, like, cool sonic panels and all kinds of stuff that either Mike Mignola has done in the past or that I know Grist has done in places. And tried my damnedest to, like, describe what that would look like. And what Grist ended up coming back with were markedly different, but I was like, yeah, that's what I was getting at. You know, like, that I knew you would know some cool thing to do that would accomplish what I'm trying to describe.
Hellboy, as a whole, feels like it would be a lot on your plate.
Yeah, it's really, particularly writing 5 different Hellboy titles at the moment, so yeah.
Yeah. You know, you're also working on other things. Edison Rex, which yes. is a book that I love, and I was so happy to see back at Comixology. Edison Rex is back with, I think, 2, 3 new issues since its return?
Yeah, so what we did, so life got in the way. We released issue 16 in July of the year 2014. That was 2 years ago. And so it took us a year to finish the next one. And so we decided to hang on to it until, you know, such time that the one after that was done. Because that 18 would be the end of the third volume, the third arc. And it comes to kind of a tidy cliffhanger, as opposed to ending on a fairly nebulous note. And then it took us like another year to finish 18. So we finally released issue 17 in, I don't know, like June of this year or something like that, June, July. And issue 18 came out, what, like 3 weeks ago, something like that, 2 weeks ago? Yeah. And part of that timing was we're stealing a page from the fine guys over at Tesladyne Studios, the Atomic Herbal guys, and retooling it as a serialized webcomic with a Patreon to support the creation of new stuff past the stuff that's already come out. So that's over at edisonrex.net if anybody wants to check that out. And what we'll be doing is releasing the entirety of what we've done so far, hopefully to a new audience, or at least a somewhat larger audience than we had with purely digital version. And when we catch up, then the stuff past 18 will start being serialized.
You listed off a lot of reasons for going digital when Monkey Brain launched. Yeah. Like, we talked to you pretty thoroughly then. Is that just, like, similar to why you decided to do it as a webcomic?
Well, hindsight is 2020. And a lot of the things that Alistair and I worked out were correct, but we didn't quite get the whole picture. We weren't quite right. I think the digital is fantastic. That's how I consume most of my individual comics now. It's still on Comixology, still digitally. But digital reached a point where everybody that was going to get a tablet or a smartphone had gotten one by then. So you got this really exponential growth for a period of a few years, and we were kind of right in the middle of that. And then the sales in the comics continued to grow as well. And then once you kind of saturated that market, that's where it's at. The problem was that there's all these different potential audiences, and digital reaches one of them extremely well, but it doesn't get into the others. So both in the print side or even the free digital, the free webcomic side. So I've had conversations with Brian Clevenger and Scott Wagner about this stuff for several years now, and watched with envy as they perfected the model. Because I think that the perfect model for doing indie comics these days is do it free as a webcomic. When you get full issues, release them digitally through Comixology and in print in comic shops, and then do trades traditionally through regular comic shops. And then if you're going to do high-end stuff, do Kickstarters for, like, you know, big omnibuses and stuff like that, when you've got a bunch of material put in there. Because that puts that book in front of every potential audience in the way that they want to consume it. And so we had some cart versus horse business going on, because our plan was do the individual issues purely digitally and then release the print trades through the direct market. But the problem was that the comic shops owners, and certainly many comic shop customers, had never heard of the book before. You know, and so it would just kind of fly completely under their radar. A copy would show up in the comic shop, spine out, and just sit there on the shelf because no one knew to look for it. I would do it differently if I had to do it again, but this webcomic / Patreon thing that we're doing now is an attempt to add some of that stuff back into our model.
Well, I think everybody should absolutely go read it. I caught up today. Like, I've been banking a few issues, and so I caught up on Edison Rex today, and these newest ones are fantastic. They're, like, really... And it makes me so mad to read them, by the way. Because you'll just throw out, like a supervillain idea for a panel, and now it's out there, and you've done it, and it's
brilliant. I gotta tell you, that is almost always Dennis Culver. Virtually, if there is a single panel genius idea, like 90 times out of 100, well, that could just be 9 out of 10. That was a stupid way of saying that. almost always, that's Dennis's idea. Dennis is like, we could do this. I'm like, that sounds great. You know, the joy of working on that book has always been, I'll come up with half an idea, and Dennis goes off and turns it into four fantastic ideas. So... yeah, you know, it was a book that we could easily have let go, you know, because we both got really busy with paying gigs elsewhere. We certainly weren't making a lot of money on Edison Rex. It never quite earned out the money that it was costing us to make it, because we're paying the colors and letters and then splitting the back end piece. But every time I saw Dennis, or every time we talked, we would just get really excited about the ideas we hadn't gotten to yet, because we had definitely worked out it gets big and crazy from where we are now. We spent like a year, like, what are we going to do? How are we going to, like, how can we finish this book? Because we have to finish this book. And so finally, it was back in the spring. It was last year. I said, let's do a webcomic, let's do a Patreon, and screw it, we'll figure it out. We'll get there somehow. And so that's what we're doing. So we're hoping enough people, like, want that to happen, that they can kind of back that Patreon and help it go.
So I want to ask you about the model that you guys kind of borrowed from the Tesla Dyne guys, the Atomic Robo mm-hmm. guys, because it sounds like a really good working model for, you know, someone who is already established to a certain level. Like, the benefit that you have and that they have is that there was an already a built-in audience for those comics. Mm-hmm. And so moving to the webcomic brings at least that audience over, and hopefully pulls in others as well. I wonder if you think that this model, because it sounded like you're very, you know, bullish on this model. Do you see this as something that could work for somebody who is just getting started, wants to do an independent comic that is their first comic, and is looking for a way to jump in?
I really do. I mean, assuming that the only costs are labor, you know, like if it's someone doing their in, what I tell people now that they ask me, like, how do you break into comics? I'm like, learn how to draw and go make your own comics. I think if someone were starting out now, I have these conversations with people starting out now. I think make something awesome and put it on the web. It's Jack Conte of Pomplamoose who started up Patreon, right? And I think that that model has a lot of merit, because it's not, you use Kickstarter to fund the creation of a specific thing, right? So if you're going to do a trade, or you're going to do some merchandise or whatever, you create a Kickstarter that has a fairly low goal, and you make that thing. But the Patreon is for whoever likes you, that wants to see more of that and wants to, you know, help be a supporter and a patron of it. So I think it's all economies of scale. If you're starting out and you don't have a big audience, then you put it on the web for free and you do what you can to build that audience. And then you don't worry about the print side of things until you get to a point where that makes sense to do so. If you can manage to partner with an established, you know, publisher to do that piece, so much the better, because they can help with the distribution, they can help shoulder those costs. But just in terms of the creation of the comic itself, yeah, I think webcomics is pretty much the way to go. And then into digital, because then you could use something like Comixology Submit to start doing digital issues or digital collections to go to a market that maybe doesn't want to read webcomics or would prefer to do it digitally on their devices.
I think that's solid advice. Would that I could take it. Would that I could take it now.
Yeah.
Well, Chris, we've talked for a while. We've touched on a lot of stuff. But I did want to get to your new novel, Firewalk, which is that out now?
That came out last week. So right at the end of October, they came out.
We do not have a lot of time to talk about it here on the show, so I'll just ask you, is it good?
I like it a lot. It is it's contemporary supernatural thriller is what they're calling it, I think. It's an FBI agent and a cop in a West Coast city investigating weirdness and serial killers and weird drug stuff, and it turns out it's all crazy supernatural wackiness.
Supernatural wackiness?
Supernatural wackiness, yes.
Well, you know, if we outlaw supernatural wackiness, only supernatural outlaws will be wacky.
Right? Right?
Chris, I have to ask you this, with the title Firewalk.
Mm-hmm.
Is that like a Twin Peaks nod? Or is it totally a coincidence?
It's not. It's this story is one that I have worked on in different forms for like 18 years, and I finally figured out how to tell the story. I'd actually done two complete versions of this story that were structurally very different or focused on different characters or had a different protagonist, and then just came back to it. And then finally, it was going to be a comic at one point, and the title has followed it the whole time. And so this is actually the first of a two-part, it's a duology, if you want to use the publishing term, because it's a two-book series. And the title actually won't make a whole hell of a lot of sense until we get to the second half. I think the movie hit, when did Firewalk with Me come out?
Considerably after Twin Peaks the show.
Yeah. I mean,
it wasn't that far after. It was 1992.
Okay, so yeah, this would have been a few years later. But it was not a conscious thing, which is funny because as it evolved, it took on a much. It kind of took on this Twin Peaks vibe to it, in a lot of ways. But I kind of liked the title, so I stuck with it.
And so what you're saying is that the sequel is not called With Me.
No. That would be good, though. I see what you did there.
I hope I honest to God hope that the title for the second one is Water Ski.
That would be good. It's actually Firewalkers is the sequel. It's Firewalking and Firewalkers, but
it could have also been Snowmobile.
It's all things, yeah.
Chris, maybe you can come back and talk to us more about that in the future. We would love to have you back on the show, because it's been about 3 years since the last time you
were
here.
It's been a while.
And you're always so fun to talk to, so fun to hang out with, just so fun to be around. But now it's the time of the interview where we like to hand things over to our listeners on Twitter to see if they want to get in on the conversation. And Matt, if our listeners do want to get on these little fun chats that we have each and every week with our friends here on War Rock and Ajax, how exactly can they go about that?
Well, Chris, the easiest way to do that is just to find somebody who can get you an in with Twitter.com. I don't know who. You find a connection. Find your 6 degrees of Kevin Bacon with Twitter, and then ask him, hey, do you think Twitter would let me post on it? I mean, look, I don't know. I've been looking at Twitter for a long time, and I don't know. Do you think that Twitter would let me do that? And then let them ask, and then Twitter will be like, sure. And then go sign up for an account on Twitter.com. Follow the Matt D. Wilson, that's me, and the ISB, that's Chris. And wait until Thursday night at 9:30 p.m. Eastern Time, that's 6:30 Pacific. One of us will put out the call for questions, just like the questions you're about to hear for Chris Robertson. And the first one, Chris, I wanted to ask you this during the interview, but it came up here, so I saved it for Twitter questions. This is from @reallastname on Twitter, Jonathan Dick. Jonathan wants to know if you have any stories about working with Mike Mignola you can share, because we talked about you working with artists,
mm-hmm.
but co-writing with Mike Mignola has to be a whole different experience.
It is. I mean, yes, it is. And I have stories that I can share. You know, that process is, it usually starts with me on the phone with Mike, just talking about monsters or something or something or some half of an idea. And a lot of times it's something I think, oh, I would like to do this, or, you know, do you have anything? He's got like a million unfinished ideas kind of laying around. And a lot of times I can hook up a half of an idea that I have with something that he's already kind of worked out, or a plot that he started and then kind of walked away from. And then other times it's he has a germ of an idea that hasn't really been germinated. And then he hands it over to me to go from there. I can talk about it, I guess, because it's about to come out. There's an issue that Patrick Reynolds is drawing called The Unreasoning Beast. It's been announced. I think it's coming out very soon. Mike and I had talked about a couple of different... there was a Witchfinder story, and then there was going to be... maybe it was in The Rise of Black Flame. Anyway, there were a couple different things that involved monkeys, right? And so he had this idea for a ghost monkey thing that would be in this story that Patrick's working on. And he said, I don't know, that might be too many monkey gags. And I was like, Mike, there's no such thing. There's no such thing as too many monkeys. That's ridiculous. So we're doing all of them.
Never it. Too many monkeys.
No,
never.
I feel like the founder of Monkey Brain is the wrong person to say,
right, oh, right?
There might be too many monkeys.
I'm like, who are you talking to? We're doing all of those.
It wouldn't be a Chris Robertson appearance on War Rocket Ajax if we didn't talk at least a little bit about Superman. So here's a couple questions about Superman. The first one is from D.A. Pinsk on Twitter. That's Dan Pinsk. He wants to know how you feel about the current run on Action Comics, the Dan Jurgens run that's happening with Rebirth. He's interested in what you think of Lex as a Superman, because his first thought was Edison Rex.
I must confess that I have not kept up. I haven't read anything. I don't think I've read any of the Superman stuff since Morrison's run wrapped up. I've heard a lot of good things about the recent stuff, but I've just gotten too distracted with other things. So I do not have a horse in that race. I don't know. I don't have an opinion.
All righty. This one I know you have an opinion on. I have no judgment. No, we talk about shit we can't keep up with on this show all the time.
Yep.
Owen Washington Hobbs, @LordOfAllHobbs, wants to know what you think is the best Superman S shield, excluding the standard S finalized in the 60s and used until the New 52. So he's taking out the best known S shield.
Right.
And wants to know what you think is the second best S shield, I guess.
It's for me, it's Darwin Cook's interpretation of the Fleischer animated one with the black background and the yellow border.
Mm-hmm.
That's my favorite.
That is a good one. Yeah. That is a good one.
Chris, do you have a favorite? Chris Sims, do you have a favorite S shield?
Well, I mean, Matt, if you want to get technical, the John Byrne shield is slightly different from the Kurt Swan shield. It's bigger. Just, you know, if you really want to get into it. Look, this is because I just recently read all those comics and wrote about them and obsessed over them for, like, 4 months. But I do really like the design of the Electric Blue S. Like, I think the Electric Blue S is cool.
Yeah. Man, I appreciated the name check in that piece. Because I spent so much time trying to rework that into a different letter for Livewire. Like, ages.
And you just eventually settled on the L?
Well, no, I knew it was going to be for Livewire, but I mean, yeah, it's a question of, like, how do I do something that evokes the lightning shield, but is an L, but is also recognizably a lightning bolt, you know? Like, how do I do that? And I'm not an artist guy, but I designed all those logos in all the emblems and whatnot in my Superman run, including the ones that nobody saw, so... My favorite, that run, was the Super Chief, and you can barely see it on panel. But I swear to God, I spent like a month on that thing.
LOTR_Dan also has a question about Edison Rex. Okay. This is Daniel, the historian. He says, Rex is a Lex type turned good. Could this work with other villains, such as the Penguin kills Batman and then turns good? I mean, we've seen that in comics here and there. I mean, the recent... Superior Spider-Man fell into that category.
I want to say somebody did that with Riddler, right? A few years ago? Basically had Riddler be... Didn't take out the Batman, but Riddler was kind of like a consulting detective guy.
Yeah, that was Dini's run on Detective Comics, where Riddler got amnesia so he would forget the end of Hush. and then became a private detective. An idea that I have talked about really, really liking in the past.
That was a nice turn. And I want to say that Busick, maybe with Prankster, did it in either, I guess it was in Action Comics, around that kind of 1 year later time. I think it was Prankster.
I don't recall, but that sounds right.
I get a little fuzzy. I'm old.
So I think our collective answer is yes, it can be done.
Yeah.
This question is from Doubting_Tom on Twitter. And this is a carryover from last week's episode. Someone asked Benito Cereno if mummies are zombies, and he said, "Let's talk to Chris Robertson about it." So here we are with Chris Robertson. Are mummies zombies?
Well, I mean, are you talking the kind of the traditional? It depends on that, or if it's the kind of the universal monster types. Certainly in the schema that I introduced along with Mike Allred in iZombie, the rules are pretty simple. So I'm gonna use that as my expertise. And that is that every person has two souls in them, which are basically the conscious and the unconscious. And depending on which one stays with the body or in what capacity, it determines what kind of monster you get on the outside. And that the zombies are the ones that come back with just the appetites, but with no consciousness. But the mummies specifically are the ones that accidentally come back with both still intact. Because our main guy is actually one of those dudes. And so I called those revenants instead. So I think Benito would probably be down with revenant as an explanation for what a mummy was.
Oh, yeah. Benito loves terminology, so
yeah.
I'm sure he would.
I'm going revenant.
Please do.
Technically not zombie.
I think Benito agrees. Benito's answer basically agreed with that.
Okay.
At Xavier Files on Twitter has a fashion query for you, Chris.
All right.
They want to know, do you prefer your pants pleated or flat?
I can't stand pleats. No, Yeah. Who prefers
pleated pants?
Pleated is real bad.
Hey, man, I was a teenager in the 80s. Like, I suffered through pleated pants. Like, I'm not going back. It's not not happening.
One last question. This is from Ben Rowe, at Sin East Ben Rowe, who wants to know, if you could be a horror monster, what would you choose to be?
You know, the thing that just popped into my head for no reason whatsoever is Gillman, but I don't have an explanation for why that would be.
Swimming skills.
I guess. He's got a good look. I mean, Creature from the Black Lagoon is a fantastic look. Except in the 3D sequel where they shaved all the scales off him and just put him in a suit. It was dumb.
Matt, do you have a monster you would like to be?
I mean, it seems like the monsters. Yeah, the monsters that honestly seem to have the coolest life and are the least tortured are vampires.
Like, yeah, but you got to murder people constantly.
I mean, you know, you got to do what you got to do. But like, if you're a Frankenstein's monster, you're in constant pain and you don't really have a mental state. If you're a wolfman, you feel guilty all the time. Vampires don't seem to feel guilty. They don't, you know, my morality would change if I'm a vampire. So that's what I'm going with.
Matt, I have always considered you to be more of a succubus.
Thank you. Chris Sims, do you have a
Dracula,
monster that you...
Obviously, I would be a Dracula in a heartbeat.
Yeah.
Sign me up. McDonald's has breakfast 24 hours a day now. We have evolved past the need for daylight.
Chris, what if I was an incubus?
That doesn't sound right.
I was going to launch into singing an Incubus song, but I literally can't think of one Incubus song. So,
okay.
Be proud of that, everybody. Feel blessed that I'm not going to sing Incubus to you.
It's weird Chris that Robertson. You have so many 311 references on episode 311, but you can't muster up a single Incubus.
Not one. Chris Robertson has been our guest, everybody. Chris, it's been great talking to you as always. Before we let you go, please let everyone know where they can find you on the internet.
I'm on the Twitters as Chris_Robertson. I'm also on Tumblr and Instagram is this new thing the kids are doing. But all I post on Instagram so far are pictures of vintage toys I buy, so that might not be that interesting for people. But Twitter is certainly the kind of the public option for paying attention to the silliness that I get up to.
Our guest has been Chris Robertson. Firewalk is out now in bookstores and on Amazon, so pick it up. Keep an eye on the Hellboy franchise, because you're going to be seeing so much from Chris. iZombie is a great series that is complete and you should read, and also watch the TV show. And Edison Rex on Comixology and at edisonrex.net. All great stuff to check out from Chris Robertson. Chris, it is always a pleasure. Thank you so much for coming on the show.
Well, thank you guys for having me. I always have a blast.
Thanks once again to Chris Robertson for joining us on the show and answering our questions. But now it is the bi-weekly segment where Matt and I answer your questions. This is Listener Questions.
Yeah, we don't have a drop for that.
Do not.
I'll just dive in. And this week we're getting the rare line stepper listener question sent in by email.
Okay.
Rare in the wild. Let me tell you something. If you're a line stepper and you want something read on the show quickly, send in a listener question. That's a pro tip for you.
Please keep in mind that your listener question cannot be which of these two characters do you like more or which of these stories.
This is from Daniel Pittman. Daniel's asking, what is your favorite tie-in issue to an event that you're not crazy about? Personally, he's a big fan of Gotham Central number 37, Sunday Bloody Sunday, in which the GCPD has to deal with Infinite Crisis. He was curious if there are other good one-off tie-ins or to otherwise dud events.
The one that comes to mind is the issue of Orion that ties into Joker Last Laugh. Because Joker Last Laugh, I didn't like... When I was younger and I had disposable income to burn, I told the comic book store that I would later work at, please sign me up for every installment of the Our Worlds at War crossover. That was a mistake. I had not learned my lesson a year later when I said, please give me every Joker Last Laugh crossover issue. So Joker Last Laugh is a huge piece of shit. It's terrible. It's like really bad. But that Orion issue involves one of the Deep Six being jokerized, and it has one of my favorite gags that Walt Simonson has ever done. It's like the Deep Six guy is fighting Orion, and he like gets him down, and he does this like, you know, he punches him in the face, and so there's like four panels of just like right hand, left hand, right hand, left hand, and then Orion gets the upper hand. And he's like, and now I shall revisit unto you three times what you have done to me. And you turn the page, and it's 12 panels of Orion going right hand, left hand, right hand, left hand, right hand, left hand. It's a visual. So it's probably not coming across really well, but I like that issue a lot because there's some fun being had with it.
Gotham Central 37 is a good call. I would say Captain America number 25, which is the single issue Civil War tie-in in which Captain America is shot on the steps of the courthouse.
That's a pretty good one.
It is a really good single issue that ties into Civil War. Some of the other tie-ins that we really like that we weren't crazy about the main series, we've talked about them on the show, but there are two really good tie-ins to Convergence.
Yes.
There's three, actually. There's three really good tie-ins to Convergence.
Four. There's actually four.
All right, well, let me name my three, and then you tell me number four, okay? There's the Atom, mm-hmm. Convergence the Atom.
Which is great, which is amazing.
There's Convergence the Question, mm-hmm. and then there's Convergence Shazam, which I think I would say if you're going to read anything from Convergence, read Convergence Shazam.
Yeah, that is, I think, a pretty solid read. I can't remember what the fourth one was that I just had in my head. I literally can't remember.
Adam, well, those three question, are good.
Yeah, I might have been thinking about Gotham by Gaslight Batman being in his own, but no, he's just in Shazam. So
yeah, he's in Shazam. Those three are good.
I quite like Invasion, the Bill Mantlo, Todd McFarlane crossover from the 80s with Keith Giffen and Bart Sears, too. I'm reading the spine of the book over on the bookshelf. I actually think the core story of that is good and fun, but the tie-ins to that are way better than you would think they would, because the tie-ins to that exist in Justice League International, Suicide Squad, Animal Man, and there's one other like really good one, and it's like the Animal Man crossover issue is where Animal Man loses his powers because of the gene bomb, which is like a big deal in Animal Man going forward. There's a lot of really good stuff in that. Yeah, I can't think of like a lot of others that would be as good as like issues of regular comics that tie in to a larger event. Final Night had some really good ones. Like the Hitman issue of Final Night is really good. The No Man's Land issues of Final Night are really good, but I like Hitman. But I like both of those crossovers more than I like, say, Joker Last Laugh. There is right. No good tie into Our Worlds at War, by the way. Heads up on that.
The thing is, like, a lot of times, if you're not invested in the crossover, you don't bother with the tie-ins all that often. But unless I'm keeping up with the series already,
yeah,
which is why, you know, I mean, I read Civil War, but you know, that's why I was reading Captain America 25, and we just happened to read those Convergence tie-ins because I think out of a sense of obligation, but they ended up being
treats. I decided to read every Convergence book 16 years later, and I haven't learned my lesson, Matt.
Daniel, I don't know if that is a totally satisfactory answer for you, but those are some tie-ins that we did like. And again, I think your suggestion of Gotham Central 37 might be the best of the best. Like, it's hard to top that. So thanks for sending in that question. If you would like to send us a listener question, you can do so on Tumblr by going to warrocketpodcast.tumblr.com and hitting the ask box. Or you could send it to us by email at our email address, which is warrocketpodcast@gmail.com. That is also where you can send panel president lists, every story ever lists, listener questions, as I just mentioned. If you want to sponsor the show, you can let us know there. If you want to send us a comment or just chat with us, send it on. Our website is warrocketajax.com. That is where you can stream the show, download the show, read show notes, and leave comments. Also, check us out on iTunes. If you go to iTunes, please leave us a review there. The more positive reviews we get on iTunes, the more we're featured. And now we've reached the part of the show where we tell you all the different places you can find us on the internet. We've made this as easy as we can. For me, all you have to do is go to mattdwilson.net, and you'll find links to all my stuff. My books on Amazon, my comics on Comixology, all my social media presences, all that stuff you can find right there. Chris, where can people find your stuff?
People can find my stuff at the-isb.com. There are links there to everything that I write, including comics. I just got a copy in the mail this week, but the Civil War II Choosing Sides paperback is, I think, out this coming week, this Wednesday. And Chad and I have the damage control story in there. It's a 10-pager, and it's honestly the best short story I think we've written in 9 years of writing a lot of short stories. Plus, there's other really, really great stuff in there, including Nick Fury by Declan Shelby. That's really awesome. So check that out if you have an interest in Civil War II. That does it for Rocket Ajax number 329. Hey, just a heads up, if you are in North Carolina, specifically in the Triangle, North Carolina Comic-Con is coming up this weekend. It's the 11th, 12th, and 13th of November. Chad and I will be there all 3 days. There's going to be some really, really awesome stuff going on. There's like a film festival curated by Young Animal that involves Big Trouble in Little China being shown at this really, really cool theater in downtown Durham. So if you're in the area, come by, say hi. I hope I see you there. I'll have copies of X-Men 92 and of the Civil War Choosing Sides book, as well as Downset Fight and some of the older stuff that I've done. Come and talk to me about Ajax. Come and talk to me about comics. We will have a good time. That's this weekend. I can't believe I forgot to mention it until just now. But yeah, should be a lot of fun. Matt, how do you think we did? Good show? Good show?
Once again, S rank.
329 in a row at the S rank. Have a great week, everybody. Yeah! Let's make some wrecks.
There's no drop there. You just jump in.
Oh, right.